Kerry, thanks for making the time today. We're excited to have you on the podcast.
Hey, Todd, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, well, good. Well, I appreciate your flexibility in doing this today. You know, as I was doing some research on your background, I mean, I think the understanding of finances in startups is not an area that a lot of people want to focus on, right? Most people come to us, they are either a product person, they're a technical person, or they're a salesperson. Usually it's one of those three buckets. And so finance and talking about you know, the cash flow and understanding metrics in their business is not one that they just run to inherently. And so this conversation will be good. But before we get into that, maybe talk a little bit about your background and how you ended up where you're at today.
Well, I'll try and keep this really short. If I talk too long, tell me to shut up. It's okay.
Okay, we'll do.
I graduated with a degree in accounting. Went to work for a couple of big Fortune 500 companies and a big eight accounting firm at the time. I think then now just a big three. Wound up getting hired away by a client of the accounting firm to a, you know, a smaller company. And what I found was working with that company was I was astounded at how much the business owner didn't know how to read financial data, didn't know the financial statements, didn't know. All they knew was sell more. And he had achieved a certain level of success and got what some business owners fall into, the disease I call affluenza. You know, bought a sailboat on the company's books, $2 million sailboat. Bought a Rolls Royce for his trophy wife. And didn't understand, now this is a time when prime interest rate was at 21%, and he had $250,000 credit line that he was paying 28% on, you know, more than the credit card. And he didn't understand the dynamics of that and how he and then what I told him, I said, you're structurally, the way you're structured now, you're going to lose money. Well, what if I sell more? I said, sell more how? Do you need capital to buy the inventory to, I don't see how you're going to get it. You need to liquidate some assets, pay down your debt. And he didn't want to let go. And he eventually wound up going bankrupt.
Oh,
but working for a couple of other companies, same thing. They didn't understand their financial statements, didn't understand what financial ratios, and you try and tell them, and it's like, you know, speaking another language. So part of what happened is one of the people I worked for is like, hey, I have these other buddies of mine. They have their own businesses. I've been telling them about you. Can you help them? So, yeah, I was helping them part-time and, you know, getting paid for it. And eventually it got to be to the point where, hey, I can make a living doing this. So 1987, I started my firm working with businesses. And along the way, got to be a certified ontological coach, which is a tool I use to help coach business owners or executives maybe to become the leaders that lead their business to the next level rather than be the autocrats that beat their company to the next level.
Yeah.
Anyway, so long story short, that's where I've been the last, 38 years.
Wow, congratulations. That's pretty cool.
Thank you. Yeah.
So when you, like, before we get into, like, maybe the specific, can you give me, like, what an engagement would look like? I mean, give me a touch point on kind of where people are at when they engage with you, the types of work that you end up doing, and the results they're trying to do. And so, like, you can genericize it. I know probably each one of them is a little bit different, but you're probably seeing some themes on doing this for 36 years.
Yeah. Well, there's four things I like to do with people. Number one, to get their attention, to get them wanting to engage, is I can take them through 12 strategies that will help them double the net profits and cash flow in a year.
Well,
all right? They like that.
That's good. Yeah, dude, I'm listening.
So now, in part of that, as they begin seeing the results of that, is we need to get you out of the business in terms of your day-to-day, free you up to go do what your best, the greatest value you can be to your business is be the entrepreneur that you were that got you into it, right? So we're going to begin documenting processes for all your critical functions. And and you tell us the results you want, we're going to have your employees design the process, and we're going to test it, make sure they produce the results you want consistently. So once you start getting consistent results out of that process, you back out of that process. And you go from, like, where's the most pain to where's the next most pain, where's the next pain.
Yep.
And you get down to where you've got process. So now you have a system of processes that runs the business. And generally, small to medium-sized businesses, you can have one, maybe two managers run the whole show. The owner is now freed up. The owner doesn't have to work $80 to $100 a week. They can take time off, et cetera, et cetera. Their mind and their bandwidth now freed up. You go see the possibilities, turn them in revenue, which is what their big gift is. Second of all, to give them some reassurance that things are going well, instead of having to go spend a day in accounting looking at financial reports, we get them a set of dashboards every week. All the KPIs, project cash flow projection, aging receivables, aging of payables, aging of inventory, whatever the KPIs are for the business, right? Where are your sales month to date as compared to budget? If you're halfway through the month and you're only 25% of where you're supposed to bill, where's the problem?
Yeah.
Is billing behind? Is sales off? Is there some big project that's going to accumulate and turn to a big billing? You need to know all that stuff. Also, your taxes being filed and paid. Things like that. So every week, they spend an hour looking at the KPIs, and the only thing that really catches their attention is one says, hey, there's a problem here. Just like the dashboard on your car. You don't really notice it until, you know, some red lights
Christmas lights.
Off, the fuel lights blinking, your battery not charging, your radiator's about to overheat. Same thing with this. So they can look at that with their leadership team every week. And the leadership team, if they're on their game, they should say, this is the problem, this is the solution we have, we're going to fix it. You know, and every now and then, the owner may have to step in or at least make some suggestions of what can be done.
Sure.
And lastly, after we have them, we increase their, we help them double their net profits, we get them processes, we get them financial actionable financial data so they can take action during the month. Lastly, we work with them. So now we're going to design your business into the future. So give me some timelines, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years out. What do you want your business to look like? And what I'm going to ask you is, what would your business have to do for you to be satisfied? Not happy. I don't care about happy. I want what would satisfy you. And by satisfaction, I mean, what is enough action? So what's going to take the, what revenue? What market do you want? What products and services are you going to be selling in the future? How many employees? What's your compensation going to be? How much time are you going to be, you're going to be able to take off? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As much detail as you can. Because the more specific you are about what's going to satisfy you, the more likely you're going to get it. And let me say it this way. If you never declare what satisfaction is, you'll never be satisfied.
Sure.
And if you look at most people that walk around with this, you know, this ain't it. You know, if my life were more better different, I'd be happy. Like happiness is something that's got to find them.
Exactly.
But they never define more, better, or different.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like making requests. You know, they all, you've heard the old, ask 10 people to build a fence, you probably get 10 different fences. But let's get more specific than that. Let's just say you ask somebody to go build a fence. You want it 5 feet high. You want it made of lumber. You want a gate every 100 yards. You want there to be 5 rails, not 4. And maybe you want it painted white. What are the details you left out? Because every detail, whatever you don't specify, is subject to interpretation.
Sure.
If it's something that's not critical to you, it's not that important, who cares? But if it is, and you don't specify it, you don't get it, it's because you didn't ask what you want.
Yep.
So, you know, the whole thing of, you've heard the thing, if you want to get what you want, you have to ask for what you want, right? Nobody's going to, like, magically, whatever, have an epistemy, and it's going to come to them. You got to ask for it. Well, before you ask for it, you got to know what you want. That makes sense?
It does.
So being clear on what is going to satisfy you is generally not, that's why we ask business owners about the critical processes. What results do you want to see? If you can't give me, I just want it to work well. That's not specific.
How hard is this? Is this a process that takes them some time to, like, most of them get, at, you know, like.
Yes, at first, it's hard because they've never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
They just want things to run well, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of, okay, so. Let's say your marketing function. How much revenue do you want your marketing function to produce?
To be responsible for.
Right?
Yeah.
How much revenue and maybe by product line or maybe by regional, by whatever it is you want, how specific can you get about, I want a marketing system that does this. Or no, an accounting system that produces financial statements on the third of every month.
Yep.
And again, you know, you can say, I want to do this, but that's generally something that, okay, we can do that. But if you want your financial statement by the third of the month, you're going to have to hire 2 more people in account.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have money for it. Okay, well, you're going to have to, until you do, you'll maybe get your financial statements on the 15th of the month. Is that satisfactory? Okay, well, for now, as opposed to adding another $7,500,000 to the payroll, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Well, maybe pivot a little bit. Like, you know, most of the people that we work with are they're technology oriented, and as I mentioned, they're early stage. So they may, you know, get to the point where they got $100,000, or maybe they're closing in on $1 million in revenue, and you know, they're really just trying to find the next set of customers, right? And so these guys are going from like early adopters that basically maybe are willing to change their behavior on something that maybe isn't perfect, to you know, figuring out a pipeline that basically is predictable because they found like an ICP, like their ideal customer profile, and they're starting to kind of build that out. And so my question to you is, what is the, how should they think about like looking at a balance sheet and thinking about the core elements of finance just to get a good grounding of it, right? There's a lot of information. Even in just your intro, you talked about a lot of concepts that they're probably not familiar with, and they're just going, it's intimidating. And so where do I start? Like, what are the basics that I really need to understand to really, and understand this stage of the business, right? Because the next stage of the business at 10 million is very different than it is at 100,000, right? Yeah. And so, but you got to kind of calibrate, what do I need to know and what's important for the stage I'm at?
Right. And listen, number one, I agree with you. If you don't speak accounting, it can be very intimidating. And the way I relate to it is, my wife and my daughter are both nurses, right? And my daughter will come over to visit, and they start talk nursing talk. In about 2 minutes, I'm like, it's
what?
A whole other language. So I just kind of fade away.
Yeah.
And that's what most business owners do when we start talking accounting. They kind of fade away because it's just, you know. I know he's speaking English, but I have no idea what he's saying.
Yep.
So the what you need is somebody who speaks accounting and can give you a good layman's language interpretation of what your financial statements are saying about your business in terms of its financial strength, your liquidity, your profitability, and your efficiency. There are ratios that measure all of those, right? How efficient is your business? Are you turning your inventory over? What kind of profits are you producing, or what kind of revenue are you producing given your assets, your net worth, et cetera? Are you financially strong? Are you liquid? That ratios of that. You know, if suddenly everything stopped, you have the money. Like, what's the expression? What's your runway? What's your burn rate?
Yeah, burn rate.
Stopped, how long can you stay in business before you run out of cash?
Yep.
So it's generally, unless you really want to learn accounting, which is going to take some time, I would get a good trusted advisor to help you interpret those financial statements. And listen, over time, what I've seen is business owners really begin to appreciate what their financial statements are saying. They don't need as much handholding, right?
So maybe even talk to me about earlier steps. Like, what tools do you put in place? You know, is QuickBooks fine? You know, like, is there some basic reporting that they can do to like get some of this information early? Because, you know, like even taxes, right? Like getting them to figure out like sales tax and that sort of stuff. You know, we're all digital products, so we don't have a lot of inventory. And once we build it, our cost to do the next copy is very cheap. It's almost free, right? And so that's unique. But on the flip side, you want to make sure that you're managing all your costs, and you're basically paying the right people, you know, especially on the sales tax perspective. And so I'm just curious on, what do you think like an early technology stack looks like? If they can find an advisor, that's great. But if they're trying to be budget conscious and they're trying to, you know, they're getting their first 25 to 50 customers, like what do they do? Like what are some tools that will help them get there?
Well, QuickBooks, some kind of accounting software would be pretty much essential, right?
Yep.
And QuickBooks is relatively cheap. And it's fairly what they call heuristic. Like checks on the screen look like a check. Invoices from vendors and to customers look like invoices.
Yep.
A check register looks like what a check register would be if you hand wrote it. But there are tutorials on QuickBooks.
Sure.
There are tutorials on pretty much anything you want. You probably find whatever you want on YouTube.
On YouTube.
How to interpret your financial statements. And you can even probably put in there, I'm a startup tech company, X amount of revenue. What financial stats should I look at? In fact, ChatGPT probably give you
pretty good indication.
What you're willing. But again, you're going to have to learn the distinctions. And what do I mean by that? If your technology, you probably have some distinctions about technology that are like obvious to you. It's what you call in your background of obviousness. You don't see it because it's back here, right?
Yep.
And you just it's a this.
Yeah.
Well, me who doesn't have those distinctions, like, what the hell is that? You know, looking at the panel, what the hell is that? I don't. What do you do with it? What's it for? So you have to get some distinctions to be able to see what accounting is telling you. You have to be able to look at ratios. You have to look at their, again, your financial statement in and of itself, just with numbers on a page, doesn't mean that much. What does it mean in terms of where you've been and where you're headed? What is your income statement or your profit and loss saying about your revenue, your cost of goods sold, your operating expenses, and in relation to each other? How much is, if your net profit is, say, 5%, but your industry's net profit normally is 10%, well, you know, what's the difference? Are your operating expenses too high? Yep. Are your cost of goods sold too high? And here's another thing, but it's not a lot of businesses, especially been around for a few years, they don't raise prices. So maybe you're undervaluing your sale. But there's a lot of distinctions to learn in there. And look, I got to tell you, it's not easy trying to learn it yourself. So if you could just have even a bookkeeper part-time, sure. You know, hourly, to help you with some of this stuff, it'd probably be good. And again, there are a lot of tutorials. But again, most entrepreneurs watching tutorials about accounting.
Yeah.
It's about like, I'd rather have my gum scraped. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Root canal, please.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we talk about, like I worked at Concur, and so they were a travel and expense company, and you know, free cash was always the big thing, right? Like, because that was the money that we could actually pile back into the business to grow. And, you know, most of the companies that we're working with are early stage and they want to grow. And so, you know, what's the difference between growing 300% year over year if you're self-funding it versus growing 30%? They're all good, but there's different kind of trade-offs to that. And if you're not raising capital through a venture capital or a private equity firm, you got to find it in your business to go do. And so to me, that was like as a young professional growing up, learning how to read a balance sheet, understanding free cash flow in our business, understanding what I could reinvest was a pretty big milestone for me. And then, you know, like we went public as a company. And so just understanding the scrutiny difference between quarterly reviews and talking to Wall Street and setting expectations and what our internal numbers meant versus our external numbers meant as a business owner, you know, like, you know, you're trying to sandbag it a little bit because you have to meet these numbers. But like internally, my bonus ties on a much higher number. Right. And so and, you know, the COO's going, not all of you are going to get to your number, but the combination of a number of you will get us to the number that we just promised to Wall Street, and hopefully our stock continues to go in the right direction. And so this is all to say that there's just a progression of learning, I think. And I think what I would say from my own standpoint was it was just-in-time learning. I had a problem, and I needed to learn more accounting, and I needed the accounting information to basically do the next jump in my career or the next division I was being asked to do. And I feel like entrepreneurs do that too. Right. When they run into problems, then basically they say, OK, I got to go learn something now.
Yeah, I've seen that in some entrepreneurs and some others like, I'm going to hire that talent.
Yeah,
there's no way I'm going to sit there and learn that stuff, but I'm going to hire some talent that can do that for me. So, yeah, there's one or two ways to go. I mean, I always encourage learning as much as possible. You don't have to be the expert in it, but you need to at least be versed enough to understand what the hell is going on.
We have a concept in our program called no black boxes. So I don't care if you're a sales guy, if you're a technical guy, you need working knowledge of all of it. You don't, like you said, you don't need to be the expert, but you need some working knowledge. And I think finance is a really good one where, again, you may not need to be an expert, but it's like if there's a problem, then you need to at least be like articulate enough and well-versed enough to understand kind of how to go troubleshoot it. You can have a partner that will get you all the information, but I do think you have to have a working knowledge. And if you outsource any component of your business over time, it's a blind spot for you that could bite you.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, one of the primary functions I say that CEOs or entrepreneurs have and business owners is they have to constantly be scanning the horizon. What possibilities are coming up that they could take advantage of, but also what perils, what dangers are out there that you either need to eliminate or navigate around.
Yeah.
And like you say, if you outsource it, especially you outsource it, and again, this is similar. I've seen some businesses go out of business because they trust the accounting department to handle taxes.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, tax man showing up, I need a check bigger than what you got in your account today.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. And what you'll find is the accounting manager has a stack of certified return receipt requested mail sitting on the thing they haven't opened. They're too scared to show the boss. And the boss doesn't know about it till it's too late.
Yeah.
So same thing. If you you can't just blindly trust that's going to be taken care of. That's why we do the dashboards. So you can see if taxes are being filed and paid. You get PDF copies of them. You know, what's your cash flow looking like? What are your receivables? You know, how are they aging? Are there any problems in there? Same thing with your payables. Is your inventory getting stale? If you're a construction company, what's your WIP report? What can process look like? If you're manufacturer, what's your manufacturing cost looking like? You know, the whole thing. Whatever your KPIs are, you should be looking at it at a dashboard that has them every week and track them over time. Same thing with financial ratios. You need to track, like, how's cash looking over time? Month to month to month. Are we building cash? Are we losing cash? What's going on? Same thing with debt, inventory, all that stuff, as well as your ratios, right? Are our ratios getting better or are they getting worse?
Some of this has gotten a lot easier over like the last 10, 12 years. I mean, even like just looking at Stripe integration, you know, that a lot of the companies that we do have credit card integration. And so the reporting on that's pretty good. We had a startup recently that was, you know, it was growing 30, 40% a year. That was good. But what they didn't realize, they were an SMB business and there was a fair amount of churn. So they were losing customers at the bottom side of it. And so, you know, they scratched their head for a little bit going like, where's all the money? And it's like, well, if you're still losing 15% of your customers every year and you think you're growing by 30%, you're not going to get all that money in the door. Right. And so, you know, it's just interesting that there's some cause and effect in all of this. Or even like another one that always is surprising to a lot of entrepreneurs is looking at the ratio of how much does it cost to acquire a customer, right? So they think like, oh, I'm going to do all this work, I can get it, and then they're great. But it's like you just spent more money than the payback on 2 years of their revenue for you. Is that a good, you know, maybe in the early days, that's okay because you're trying to get it. But once you're trying to scale your sales organization, you can't have that. That's got to be below like 12 months with all of your spiffs and your commissions inbuilt in it. And so again, I think a lot of entrepreneurs start to think about these problems when they have the problems. And I think what you're trying to advocate for is there's a framework for the stage you're at. You should get invested in that proactively. And then as you hit these different plateaus, you should invest more in it to make sure that your business scales with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're responsible. You know, the buck stops with the head guy.
Yeah.
There's a book, and I forget the guy's, Jayco. He's an ex-Navy SEAL. Oh, he wrote a book called, was it The Ultimate Leadership?
Extreme Ownership.
Extreme leadership.
Basically, extreme leadership,
is in the SEALs, if a mission goes wrong, it's a team leader's fault.
Yeah.
Either you didn't prepare your guys enough, you didn't have the right gear, you didn't have the right intel. You were missing something that your team needed that they failed on their mission. And that's the same thing with if you're the owner of the business, you're the CEO, extreme ownership. Yep.
I totally agree. And I think we preach that quite a bit because it's like, it doesn't matter where it broke down. It broke down on your watch. And so I'm curious on the people that you work with, how many of them have that kind of extreme leadership kind of mentality? Do you think that that's something that most of them have because they've survived long enough? Do you think some of them learn to grow into that? Or do you think that a lot of them, it's just foreign?
Let me put it this way. Very few of them grow into that. Very few. You know, and over time, they get to be a little more, I guess, self-aware. And like everything that happens to me, I'm the central thing that happens to me, all the good times, all the bad times, I was there.
Yeah.
Right. And that's hard for some people to swallow because the narrative that some people live by has them be somewhat skeptical, cynical. Somebody's out to, they're out to screw me on this. I have one client, you know, what did he tell me? He said, yeah, the thing I keep learning about life, there's always somebody trying to screw me.
It's a tough way to go through life, man.
It's not personal.
It isn't. No, not at all.
But yeah, you know, different people mature in different ways. You know, I know people in their 80s that are still protracted teenagers.
Yeah.
Some people get it, some people don't. Some people are, you know, pretty wise in their 30s.
Yeah, or can be. Yep. Before we get on, you were telling a story a little bit about people using their company almost as a cash machine and not just understanding, you know, out. I think you talked a little bit about some of the egregious purchases that they were doing and maybe the outcome. So maybe you could recount that as, you know, it looks like the business is doing well. I want to start taking money out of it. I've worked on this maybe for 10 or 15 years. I'm due this. My lifestyle needs to increase. And maybe just recount the story and maybe the outcome that it came with.
Yeah, you know, it's not just one story. It's a number of stories over the years. You know, you see somebody, they get successful. They think it's blue skies forever. The trend is always up, and it never is. It's up and down. Now, the overall trend can be up, But you're going to have some
downtime. It's a zigzag. Yeah.
What you don't want to do is get a bad case of affluenza, is what I call it. And next thing you know, you're putting in a sailboat into your business, an expensive sailboat. That's one guy who had a $2 million sailboat that he put in his business, refused to liquidate it when things were down. Another guy I know, he had a very successful concrete company, you know, cement trucks and all that stuff, doing well. Well, he was, you know, he's doing real well. So what did he do? He went and bought a horse ranch.
Okay.
And put it into business. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't be able to afford things. You know, you should, but don't have them part of the business. They're not income generating, right? They're not going to add to the business. They're going to be an anchor on the business.
Yeah, liability.
So, you know, every now and then I ask these people's priorities. I know one guy, they had a really good year, so he went out and bought him a Tesla for cash. Except that he didn't ask, like, how do I do this so I don't – he just took the money out and, you know, and paid himself and bought a – I said, okay, so that's a loan now. Why is it a loan? It's my money. Yes, it's your money, but it's in your corporation, which the IRS sees as a separate entity. When you take money out of that, it's probably going to be a taxable event.
Yep.
So we need to structure the event like a loan that you're going to pay I don't know, probably 20-something, close to $30,000 in income tax on your vehicle. So it's, you know, it's lessons like that, people. I guess the thing is always keeping in perspective, it's not going to be great forever. You're going to have downturns, right? Never spend to where your business is now shackled to something that's a non-producing asset, right? And if you want to have some toys, that's fine. Have them in your name outside of the business. Be able to pay for them yourself out of your income.
So we talk a little bit about, and I guess I picked this up from Concur, is basically more of a margin of safety, right? Like you can make choices in your business, but like if things go bad, there's still this margin that we can absorb and you can still live through it. And, you know, we were a company that was growing. We went through, you know, kind of the dot-com in 2000. We went through 2007. Where, you know, the financial crisis, we've been through a bunch of these. And, you know, basically what we were trying to do is basically say there was a margin of safety in our business that our investment where, like, if it all went bad, like not everything needs to go bad and model it. And so you're super conservative, but you have to have some margin of safety in the way that you think about your business. And so I don't know if that's something you preach or like something you think about, but like, I think that's one thing that we always try to remind people of, like, you can't spend it all, like, it's all going to be perfect and everything's going to line up, because it's not. Right. And it's super hard with startups when they've only got maybe one revenue stream to start with, where they're banking everything on this, and my hiring philosophy on this, my bonus is going to be here, and, like, it's all tied to it. But the margin of safety, if one thing goes wrong, they can't execute on the plan.
Yeah. It's very similar to building a house of cards. You know, the first semi breeze that comes by knocks it all down.
So
you have to, and again, that's understanding the structure of your business, the financial structure. Financially, are you sound? Are you secure? Are you strong? If not, if you're kind of rickety, you know, rickety piece of furniture, it's not going to take much to take you out. Yep. So yes, you have to build up those reserves. You have to have some countermeasures to bad times, because they will come. As you just mentioned, they had the 2000 dot-com bubble. They had 2000 banking bubble that, you know, all the derivatives and stuff. And listen, there'll be COVID for a lot of business, a lot of retail businesses,
killed them
out of business.
Yeah.
There's always something coming down the road that it's not going to be conducive for you, but I don't care what you do.
Yeah. I mean, even the tariffs today, you know, you talk to some local business owners, and it's like they're just struggling, going, I used to get everything from China. I loaded up, you know, in anticipation. My inventory is dwindling. You know, I'm going to be out of business if I have to reorder because I can't just pass on those costs. And so, but like, you know, you talked to business owners 2 years ago, they weren't thinking about that problem at all.
Well, yeah, because that wasn't on the horizon.
That wasn't on the horizon at all. Yeah.
But yeah, you know, there's some things you can plan for, some things you can't. That's why it's important to have this margin of safety, as you say, built into your business. You need to have some reserves. Need to have good banking relationships. And listen, banks don't want a company that's always been perfect.
Yeah.
One of the top things bankers that I've talked to over the last, 40 years, one of the big things they look for is a company that's been in trouble and gotten themselves out of it.
Okay. Yeah.
That's one of the big things. Yeah, they want a healthy financial statement, set of financial statements, but they also want to know you've had some bad down times and you were resilient enough, you were smart enough, whatever you want to call it, to get yourself out of the hole.
So I think that's
they will put a lot of they'll bank that.
Okay. Let's talk about banking, because I think this is one that's interesting. You know, I think a lot of our companies end up using Mercury. You know, they're maybe a little more progressive. I think that a lot of our local banks, honestly, do not understand technology very well. And so they're basically brick and mortar. They want to see physical assets. And when you're talking about digital assets, they get a little skittish. And so what you end up seeing is we end up tending to see people use Mercury for a while until they have a track record and there's enough of an annuity through recurring revenue to really engage a local bank. And usually what they're ended up doing is they're engaging a local bank for more of a line of credit, right? And so that's kind of more of that margin of safety, the timing of receivables maybe isn't perfect, or, you know, I've got some lag in something, or my collectibles are like, I'm not getting all my revenue right away. A bunch of credit cards failed, and so I have to go get it. So I use this line of credit. So maybe talk to me about banking relationships early on this. And I'm assuming that a lot of the banks a lot of the companies you use maybe do use local banks because they're more comfortable with the assets that they have. But like, when do they start to look at like line of credit and some of these other assets as a financial instrument to use in times of need, not to kind of just necessarily fuel growth?
Right. Well, you have to have somewhat of a track record before a bank's going to give you a line of credit, and you have to find the right bank. And let's see, very few of my clients bank with, quote, a local
okay.
bank. Most of them, yep. most of
a
them
national.
Use at least a national footprint.
Yep.
And some use some of these big, like I know one client uses Chase. I don't know why. Chase has, from my perspective, become very bureaucratic. Decisions are slow. They have the rules, and if you don't play by the rules, they'll call you a loan or something. They
sure.
won't play ball. So you want a bank that's geared to business. You have to know the personality of the bank. Like in my area, there's one or two banks that love real estate. Why? I don't know. But every loan they have, you have to have some real estate pledged as collateral. Other banks are more retail-oriented. They're more consumer-oriented, right? They don't really care that. In fact, I know one of them, about a year ago, they closed their entire business loan department. All the business bankers, they all got pink slip. They decided not to. But there are a couple of banks here that are very much business-oriented. They love good businesses. They love good businesses with owners that understand their numbers and have mm-hmm. shown a track record. And yes, when do you get a line of credit? Pretty much when you don't really need it that much.
Exactly. That's the problem.
Right? I know that sounds crazy. But that's no. when you really don't need it that much, banks are going to be much more likely to loan you the money. Yeah. So you want the line of credit established and a track record managing a line of credit with a bank so that when the bad times do hit, you've got this line of credit, they're not going to yank it from you.
Yeah.
Make sense?
Yeah,
and over time, if you manage it right, they will increase it to help your business grow. And yes, unless you have a pile of money that you can put in your business, you're going to need outside capital to grow your business. As you grow your business, your receivable is going to grow, your inventory is going to grow, your personnel, everything's going to grow, and all that takes money. You have to fuel that with money.
Sure.
And if you're trying to do it with just profits, you never have enough money. Generally, my experience is it's almost never have enough money to put back in the business. You don't have enough put back in the business to help it grow. So you're going to need some outside. I mean, a lot of my clients in the first couple, 3 years, one of the big things I help them do is find lines of credit. And there's a lot of new alternate financing that's available now that 3, 4, 5 years ago wasn't even around.
Wasn't available. Yep.
So, yeah, there are people that are private lenders. Now, they're going to be more expensive than a bank.
Yeah.
But most of them don't require personal guarantee.
Yeah.
Right? And they're going to loan based on what your cash flow is like. So if you have enough cash flow, they'll loan you the money. If it goes bad, you haven't guaranteed the loan like the bank's going to have you do.
Yeah, with your personal house
and whatever.
Yeah.
You need to be able to speak banker. They have a whole language themselves. They see the world very differently. Business owners, we see opportunities. From their perspective, they see risk. How do we mitigate risk? That's the main concern. How do we protect the bank's assets? How do we mitigate risk? And that's why they tend to over-collateralize loans. All the things that are contrary to what the business owner wants to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple pieces in that. I think one, the bank never knows your business the way you do. And so, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs make that assumption that basically, can't you see what I'm seeing? And then I think as an entrepreneur, you're pretty risk averse, or you're pretty risk tolerant anyway, because you started it. And bankers are not. And so you start with this point where you're a ways away from it to start with, and they don't know your business the way you do. And so sometimes that's super difficult conversations. And I think what I would always encourage is building a relationship longer term exactly. with the bank, right? Where it's like, I don't need the money today, but I'm starting to educate you on my business. I'm telling you what's going on. I gave you an update every quarter. And then when I do need the money and we're ready, it's not a cold discussion. And right. I do think that that takes time, and you got to make the investment to make that happen.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was getting ready to say it's about establishing a relationship over time, right? Because if you think about the whole process, the whole thing of trust, you're not going to trust a total stranger, right?
Yeah.
But if you get to know somebody over a period of years and they're telling you, like, what's working, what's not working, I got this problem, we fixed it, whatever, you're gonna have some confidence about them telling you the truth, number one. And number two, you know, you can work with them. They're not going to hide anything. And bankers, and again, bankers are humans. They look for that too.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the things we also talked about kind of before we got on was talking about like just founder growth. And so we were talking about a little bit about how we see, you know, entrepreneurs, when you first start out, you have to either do it all yourself or you have to convince other people to come along. Right. And so the type of communication style, and you're in kind of a do mode where you're basically, it's you and maybe a couple of other people. And so you're responsible for doing a lot of things. As that business develops and you start to have success, you can't do it all. And so then you hit a plateau that's saying, like, I got to start delegating. And so I think in a lot of cases, you know what the right answer is. And you're basically delegating it to somebody and just telling them, just do it. And, you know, a lot of times you wish you could do it better than what they did, but they realize the opportunity cost to doing that, right? And so you have to give that away to go do it. And then the next one is creating some ownership, right? Where it's like saying, okay, you own marketing, you own sales. I'll add value, but you have to own it. And then I think the last piece for me is like, you see people that start to empower people, right? Where it's like saying, now they think about it as their own business, right? And those are leaders from tomorrow. And so what we see is like, there's a continuum of entrepreneurs and founders growing through each one of these, and they get stuck. They get stuck at different inflection points from a plateau and scale perspective. And so you've worked with a lot of people over the last 36 years. Like, is that a pattern that you see? And then maybe talk to me about like how, if they do, like, do they get stuck? What do they do to get out of that? And do you think that progression is the right one?
Yeah. And yes, I agree. What I've seen is that business will hit a plateau, right? And generally, initially, it's when the business has grown to the extent that the owner can still wrap their hands around it, right? Still have their hands in everything, control everything. And to go beyond that, they're going to lose control and things are going to go bad, right? So what that takes is, as we talked about, you need to begin to build processes to where the business can run by process rather than by the boss always rushing in and being the white knight.
Being the hero.
Right?
Yeah.
Also, as a business, if you're talking about really scaling and getting big, you're going to have to, as the owner, you're going to have to be willing to give up some of the ownership, some of the benefits, some of the money, some of the decision-making process, right? If you by yourself can only take things so far. But again, it's a matter of a couple of my clients that grow up some pretty big organizations, you know, they'll tell you, I'm not good partner material. I don't share well, right?
Yeah.
Whereas other guys I know, they were willing to give up piece of the company, and they grew really big, went public, eventually sold the public company to another company and walked away with, you know, $250 million. And the guy, the most successful guy I know that still owns everything, I don't know. I don't think he'd get $250 for it. He might be doing that in revenue right now, but I don't think he'd be getting that if he sold it all. Because it's, you know, he's still too much my way about everything. He micromanages everybody. And that's only going to get you so far. So, you have to be able to grow. And what I really encourage people to do is to have some vision that's bigger than you, a vision that's going to attract followers, right? That's what true leadership is. It's having some vision that's bigger. It's not about just you and my money and my wealth and my cash and my lifestyle and my, that's what most employees hear. Talk about my business, my money and my, what's in it for them, right? So you have to have a vision that's bigger than just you, that's going to attract the right people to follow you and have you be part of their vision. But in doing that, you also have to show them, this is your vision, this is your mission within this bigger vision, this is what you're going to get out of it. Which means you have to be willing to share some decision making, some of the ownership, some of the income, some of the, you know, or not. You know, if you keep it to where you got to control everything, you might attract some good people, but a lot of what you're going to attract people who are looking just for a paycheck. Yeah. Or you're going to attract some mercenaries.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, maybe, and I guess the part that I would say is, I think each business and founder has a path, and not all of them need to be high growth. And so if you are self-aware enough to know, I want to control everything, and I'm fine getting to a certain size, then that's okay, right? I think we're okay with that. I mean, if you basically have that philosophy and you have aspirations of going public, then that's not going to work, right? You have to change some of the attitude. I think we were talking a little bit about before just the motivations of employees versus founders or entrepreneurs and how there's a mismatch in the business a lot of times. I had somebody that was going through our program a while ago, and she had good success. She got into like $5 million, but she was just whipping her employees so hard, and they were getting redlined, and they were just peeling off. And basically just quitting. And basically she was working 80 hours a week, but it was her golden ticket, right? Like if she sells that business, she's done for life. Whereas the line employees that were peeling off were like, I'm not working 80 hours for you. Like it's just not worth it for me. And so there was a mismatch in expectations. And I think she didn't internalize this, like saying, why don't you see the potential and the opportunity the way I do? And it's like, well, they do, but their financial incentives are very, very different than yours.
Well, I have a slightly different interpretation of that.
Okay.
You know, the fallacy of human beings is when we look out in the world, we think we're seeing some objective set of whatever. And like everybody else can do the same thing. Well, you might see the same objects, but you can have a very different experience of what you're seeing because we all have our own narrative. We all have all the opinions and prejudices and value judgments, everything else we've had growing up and taken on. And generally when we have some, like, yeah, that's it, we generally look to gather evidence to validate that. So we get to be very right about their opinions. In fact, we don't see them as opinions anymore. We see them as the truth, not just what's true, but the truth in capital letters.
Right.
And we make all kinds of big judgments and opinions, and you know, we peg-hole people and what have you, all kinds of stuff. It's not really us choosing consciously. It's your narrative does the choosing for you. Your narrative tells you how to react. Your narrative tells you how to feel. You know, so when you see things, like I think I asked a question, you see with your eyes, you hear with your ears. Yes, biologically something happens. But the interpretation comes from the narrative that seeing those pictures in your head and telling you good, bad, right, wrong, like it, don't like it, makes sense, don't make sense, agree, don't agree. So a business owner is going to see the world a certain way, right? They're going to want to take risks. They want to take action. They want to make things happen. They're impatient. They don't like a bunch of rules. Whereas the typical employee, which is about 80% of the population, they want a steady job, steady paycheck. They don't want to take a bunch of stuff home. They don't want to worry about it on the weekends. They want to come do their job and go home. And the business owner is going to be there, you know, so it's like, why don't they see what I see? I mean, they have eyes, don't they? Because they have a different perspective. So their perspective is not going to allow them to see some of what you see, but they're going to also see some things that maybe you need to be aware of. You're not going to see what they see.
So maybe I think we're honing in the same thing. So I generally agree with what you're saying. I think what's interesting to me is when you look at founders, they are, you know, they're certainly interested in risk. They're disdain for authority in a lot of cases. And then the first couple of people that they hire are maybe a derivation off of that, but they share a lot of the same things, right?
They tend to hire their own image.
They do. And then like over time, the further and further you get out and the more stable this company is, the people that you're talking about, which want a steady paycheck and benefits and all that sort of stuff, start to fit in. And so your leadership needs to be indicative of the type of people that you've hired to go do that. So I don't disagree with the range. I just think that a lot of times, you know, whether you're a two-person company or you're 10 or you're 20, like depending on where you are in that spectrum, it attracts different people from a risk profile standpoint and have different expectations. Am I getting equity in a company? If I've got equity in a company, then maybe I'm more interested not in putting the 80 hours, but maybe 60 hours. But if I'm not getting any equity and it's a paycheck, then basically I'm going to punch the clock and I'm going to do the job you want me to do.
Yeah. George Carlin, one of his acts said, you know, most people work just hard enough not to get fired and make just enough money not to quit.
Right.
And that's pretty much the vast majority of workers in America. You know, and again, listen, you're saying, you know, is there some equity for me? Some people really don't, they really wouldn't, well, what would I want equity? Oh, it'd be a big paycheck? Okay, but what do I have to do? Do I have to do much more than I'm doing now to have that equity? Oh, well, I'm not that interested in it. Now, some people just, they just want a 40-hour work week and a steady paycheck. They don't want anything more.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's like, I mean, from my standpoint, the company that I went from, we started at $7 million my first year in 1997, and we sold in 2014 for $8.3 billion.
Wow.
And so, yeah, and so, you know, like, equity was, that was the thing, right? Like, I mean, if I didn't have equity in the company, working that hard to, like, get there, you know, and it was a life-changing event by the time we actually got to that point.
Yeah.
And so, and it wasn't just me. There was hundreds of other people that benefited, you know, maybe to the same degree that I did. And not all companies get to go do that. There's, you know, I mean, we've seen some companies go to basically an employee-owned model where basically they have equity in it and they're getting dividends at the end of the year, which is great. You know, we've seen liquidity events where people basically have money in it and then basically or have some sort of equity and then a private investor comes in, you know, either VC or private equity, and they basically buy out and give them some liquidity in that. And so,
right.
You know, we see it more in technology high-growth companies. But like, I agree with you. I think some people, that's just not what they're interested in.
Yeah.
And so
they don't want the responsibility. They don't want the hassle. But a great example of what you were just talking about, you've made with Dell Computers, the story of how Computers.
Oh yeah.
And they had people that were paying secretaries and what have you in Dell stock, which wasn't worth that much at the time.
Yeah.
And again, it wasn't the whole paycheck they were getting. And next thing you know, Dell Computers took off, and around Austin, Texas, they had what they called Dellionaires.
Yeah.
People who were millionaires because of the Dell stock down. So you had secretaries, clerks, whatever. Suddenly they're worth $1 million, $2 million because of the stock they owned in Dell. Now that gave them some skin in the game, as you say.
Oh, totally.
Right.
I mean, so I was at Microsoft earlier too, before 97. And so same sort of deal, right? Like, you know, my wife was there, you know, multiple stock splits. People cared about the stock price because they had equity in that. There was also a time where Concur was worth about 28 cents. We were way under a dollar, and we were in danger of being delisted on the stock exchange. And they basically said, we don't have enough cash. Can we pay you in shares? And because my wife worked at Microsoft, I was like, it's a gamble. And so I took, you know, basically, I think I took maybe 6 months worth of just shares, but it was at 28 cents, 30 cents. And so, you know, and again, you knew that that could go to zero. And you were like, okay, my rate of failure, my wife's got a decent job, I can go find something else. But on the flip side, if this gets out of the dollar range and gets sold, you know, it's a bet that I'm willing to make. And so there are some of those stories, don't get me wrong, but they're a minority in comparison to the vast majority of businesses in the United States.
So what did Concur eventually go to when it got sold?
I think we were $72, something like that. $72, something like that. Yeah, I think.
$28 is $72.
Yeah. And so that's
a good ROI.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't keep it all the way through all that. We did sell some along the way, but we did very good. So it wasn't bad at all. And so.
Hell, so $10.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. So, but maybe we pivot a little bit. Another area, I think, on the financial side that people get squirrely about is taking investment. And so one of the things that we try to articulate a little bit is if you can control, so maybe the worst case scenario, we've seen a bunch of businesses that take a bunch of money and they have liquidity preferences. They have all these terms that they're unfamiliar with in their term sheets. They try to negotiate some of the ones that they're familiar with or somebody has told them. And then, you know, like basically we've had this with a couple of where zero interest rates went away and basically the portfolio that they've invested in is now worth half the price. And so now the IRR, the internal rate of return for their investors, is not what they're thinking about. And they start, you know, doing some pretty egregious things to these startups, because they're, you know, afraid of what's happening. And so a lot of what we've encouraged our founders to do is not create a lot of classes, separate classes, you know, from preferred shares, that sort of stuff. Stay in common, stay away from liquidation preferences, and try to basically have as much control as you can. And so growing, even though you have the opportunity to grow, taking money has strings. And I think what a lot of people don't quite understand is, are you better selling a company at $40 million where you own the majority of that and have control all the way through it? And so if you slow down in growth or you accelerate in growth, you're fine, versus selling for $200 million, but yet your equity is small and you got booted off the board because you didn't perform. And we've seen this time and time again where, you know, the investors in VCs and private equity growth are motivated by an IRR. They want to return that money back to them. And so they do not care nearly as much about your founder's success as they do the returns on their funds.
Yeah. I mean, Steve Jobs, great example of that, right? He got kicked out of
his own company.
Until the company was tanking. You're like, please come back.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you see any of this, and do you coach at all on this? Because I think this is an area, again, where it's like your financial literacy is important. What do these VCs look at? What do they care? You know, what is the rule of 40 in our world? What are, your payback periods, like we talked about, customer acquisition costs? Like, there's a whole bunch of these terms that they care about, and making sure, A, you're literate with them, and then B, understanding how they're motivated and what they structure is super important to being eyes open when you take money.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you familiar with the TV show Mad Men?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Remember when they sold the firm to this British firm?
Yep.
And the Brits were coming over there saying lay off so many people and stuff.
Yep.
And they were all complaining about it. And the Bert Cooper, the older guy, said, we took their money. Now we have to do what they want.
Exactly.
The same holds true with venture capital. Venture capital, they're about making money, right?
They are.
They're not, they don't have any high lofty goals or ideals or any of that stuff. They're in it to make money. So yes, be very careful with the venture capitalists is my cautionary tale. Some of them aren't so much venture capitalists as they are vulture capitalists, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're looking for some carry on to prey on.
Yep.
And they don't care if it's you.
Yep.
They don't care about what it does to you. So yes, be very careful when accepting money. Who's it coming from? What's their reputation? And spend some money on a good lawyer to tell you exactly what your agreement says. And can you live with those terms? You know, if there's some terms you can't live with, walk away.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the other part is, too, is just don't look at it as money. A lot of them are good, and they do have connections. I think what we find in our region is the first couple of rounds are maybe generic people that maybe are good founder money, and so they stay with common shares. They are good additive to the board, but they're not domain expertise type of people. But as you grow, and if you need something in prop tech, or you need something in advanced manufacturing, or if you need something in a specific domain expertise, go find money that actually has those connections and has sold businesses in that region. Because then they have a lot more contacts maybe than you do to open doors on the sales front, as well as partnerships, as well as sales at the end of it, like when you want to sell your business.
Right. Yeah, what I call finding smart money.
It is.
You want money that's not just going to go into your business, but you have some smarts behind it that can help you grow your business, scale your business, form your business the way it needs to be for you to be successful. Instead of just, here's some money, these are our parameters, you meet them or we'll yank all your funding.
Yeah, yeah. So we're kind of running to the end here, Kerry. I appreciate your time. I guess just maybe wrapping this up, if you had to come up with three different just takeaways about your experience and how to help early stage founders, what would it be?
Probably number one is like, know, at least have some idea of your end game. What's your point on the horizon? What's your true north? What's your north star? Whatever you want to call it.
What does success look like?
Yeah, what is success? And not just in terms of money.
Right.
In terms of your life, your family, your
balance,
all the different things, your relationships, your friends, your physical health. I've seen a lot of business owners, they will work themselves into an early grave. You know, there's too many of them that I've seen that are both diabetic and taking insulin and taking high blood pressure medication. You know, because they work in 80 to 100 hours a week. When they pay attention to any of that stuff. So, yes, have some point on the horizon that you're headed to. which is not going to be that clear. Do you have a second? I mean, I was raised on a farm, right? And once this is back in the 60s, when farming was still, at least where we were, two mules and a plow. So in the spring, you turn the dirt over to kind of let the dirt air out. And in the spring, is planting, you have to replow the rows, right? So it's very important that you plow the first row straight, because the rest of the rows are going to line up the way
build off of it.
So if your first row does like that, then it's not efficient. So one of the things I was taught when I was a kid is you take a stick, have a red rag or something that you'll be able to see from a distance, put it at the end where you want it to be, get your starting point, and you focus on that red rag. And you just keep all your whole job is to keep the two mules pulling towards that spot of the horizon. I know it's kind of a corny cornball thing, but yeah, it's the best analogy I can come up with.
Sure.
At the same time, you also want to be clear about what's going to satisfy you, like in the near term, in the further term, further you go out. It's going to be less and less clear as you go out, and part of finding out what satisfies you is going to have to be some experimentation. You're going to find some things you don't like, you thought you wanted. Give you an example. When I was a teenager, first started dating, crazy looked really fun and exciting until you actually dated crazy. Then you had to deal with crazy. It's like not so fun anymore.
No, right? Not fun anymore.
So the same thing in business. You're gonna kiss some frogs.
Sure.
Right? But knowing what you want, being specific about what is enough action to satisfy me, is going to help you a whole lot in terms of focusing what is going to serve you best rather than, let me try this, let me try that. A lot of business owners, they're distracted by the next shiny object, right?
Yep.
So spot on the horizon, knowing what satisfaction is, and taking consistent action. Let me put it this way. Being resilient, not letting things get you down. You know the old expression, winners never quit, and quitters never win. It's only over when you stop.
Yep.
You know, think of Thomas Edison. He invented, he came up with 10,000 different ways that didn't work as a light bulb. When he finally came up with the one, the incandescent bulb, he was interviewed. He's like, you know, what was it like failing 10,000 times to find a light bulb? And he kind of like, I didn't fail 10,000 times. I found 10,000 ways not to make a light bulb.
Yeah.
It's a matter of perspective. It's a matter of not quitting.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I have a slightly different take on that same. I always think that I have selective amnesia sometimes, where it's like you kind of forget. You remember kind of what happened yesterday, and it was bad, and you're like, okay, but I got to get up and try it again, right? And so having selective amnesia sometimes is a helpful, at least entrepreneurial skill, where you just like keep charging forward because you're like, I know where the rag is, to use your analogy. I just need to keep getting there. So
yeah. Absolutely.
Well, this is good, Kerry. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your wisdom. You've got a lot of lessons learned, you know, in your experiences. And I think a lot of these have been really good and actionable for our entrepreneurs. So thank you for taking the time.
Hey, my pleasure, Todd. Enjoy the conversation.
Thanks. If you enjoyed the podcast today, please just take a moment to rate it or comment on it for us. This feedback really helps us, and it helps us get the word out to helping other entrepreneurs and founders. Thank you.